Okay, so it's Exodus chapter 3, and it's page 55 of the Church Bible. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. And then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place in which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them to the land, bring them out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, Say this to the people of Israel, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice, and the elders of Israel shall go to the king and say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So shall you plunder the Egyptians.
Thanks very much for reading, Helen, especially those difficult names. Keep Exodus 3 and 4 in front of you, everyone, not because I'm going to be testing you on those six names later on, although I might do if things get a bit slow, but because it'll help you to see what I'm saying and where it's coming from as we try and engage with God's word. Well, it's God's word, so we ought to ask him for his help in understanding it, but also in our hearts and our minds receiving it. So let's do that. Father, thank you that we've got these words in front of us on the pages of your word, the Bible. Thank you that they're people's words, but they're also at the same time your words. Thank you that as we come to understand them, we hear you speaking to us. We pray that that would really be our experience now over the next few moments as we dig into your word. Give us ears that are ready to listen, minds that are ready to be challenged and changed, and hearts that are ready to obey. Amen. Well, is there any more basic question than who is God? There probably isn't, is there? Especially not when we're in this kind of context here in a
a church service. Who is God? Because let's face it, just simply using the word God is not enough. That doesn't really tell you a heck of a lot, because after all, the Muslim and the Christian alike use the word. But Muslims would be very, very offended to have it suggested to them that their God is the God of the Bible, Trinity. They'd say, well, God has no son. Allah has no son. See, it's all about what meaning you pour into that word. Hindus, Sikhs, Zoroastrians, Christians, Muslims, each have different answers to that question. Who is God? The last three US presidential inauguration ceremonies, you know, when they induct the new president into his job, the last three, they've all involved controversy over the prayers that were prayed. And the controversy is centered around each time someone has led these prayers. It's been an American pastor of a Christian church. They've led the prayers and they've been too overtly Christian. They've mentioned Jesus' name. Or they've said something to make it clear that the God they're addressing is the God of the Bible. And it's caused offence, and some people have complained. Somebody even brought a lawsuit saying that they shouldn't be using the word Jesus, they should just use the generic word God. As if simply using the word can paper over the cracks or sort of do away with the fact that actually between all the different faiths of the world there are deeply held, precious differences in what that word means. You see, it's not about the word, it's about the meaning that you pour into it. And tonight we're thinking about that question, who is God? Moses asks it there in verse 13. Just have a look, right in the middle of that chapter that was read. Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Who are you, God? Who is God? It's there in the middle of the chapter, but really, actually, the whole chapter's about it. Who is God? Now, the question was really, really important, because if you remember where we left last week, the Israelites were crying out to their God. Just flick over to the end of chapter 2. Verse 23, during those many days the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning. They were crying out to God, and they were crying out to him for salvation. And the point is, well, is it worth it? Is it worth crying out to God? Is he reliable? Who is this God that we're talking to? If we're going to depend on God, then we ought to know some information about him. Just simply the word God won't do. If not, then we might find ourselves in the confusion of Homer Simpson, who famously said, I'm not a praying man, but if you're up there, please save me, Superman. Some Barts seem to get the confusion as well. On another occasion he said, aren't we forgetting the true meaning of Christmas? You know, the birth of Santa. So you get God wrong, or get the wrong God, and, well, what's the use in crying out to him? You might as well be crying out to Superman or Father Christmas. The other danger, of course, is that we think we've got the God of the Bible nailed. We think, yes, I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian for so many years. I know God. That's it. I've got him nailed. There's nothing more for me to learn. Well, the God of the Bible, precisely because he's the real God, if we let him, will constantly surprise us. Constantly show us something new about himself, constantly blow our expectations out of the water for what he's really like, constantly challenge us in our ideas about what we think he should be like. So in other words, tonight, really, the Bible is inviting us all to come fresh to it with that question, who is God? And to let God himself reveal himself to us. Let us, if we want to know him, to come and know him on his own terms, the real creator God. And there's three things that I want to pick out from this chapter, trying to summarise what it is that we're being shown about this God. Who is God? Well, firstly, God reveals himself as the compassionate rescuer. It's the first 10 verses. God reveals himself as the compassionate rescuer. And it is God who reveals himself. That's really emphasised in these first few verses. It's all God's initiative. See, Moses isn't looking for it, is he? He's just, in verse 1, keeping the flock
of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. He's just wandering around the desert doing his job, going about his daily business. He's totally unaware that he's arrived at the mountain of God, a significant location. Totally unaware. And yet God is seeking him out. So verse 2, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. God appears to him in the form of this angel. The angel of the Lord crops up a number of times in the Old Testament, and each time he does, it's actually slightly confusing as to who this angel is. You see what I mean there in verse 4? When the Lord saw that Moses turned aside to see. Well, we've just been told it's an angel, and yet somehow this angel is so closely identified with God that God is really meeting with Moses here. I don't really know how to solve that conundrum, but it happens a lot in the Old Testament. God is somehow, through this angelic appearance, genuinely meeting with Moses. And he's seeking him out. Moses isn't seeking him out. It's the Lord who calls him in verse 4. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, Moses is just interested because he's seen a bush that's on fire, but it's not burning up. He doesn't think he's about to have an encounter with God. God sees him, and God calls out to him, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Verse 5 shows why it's always going to be the case that God has to reveal himself. He can't be figured out with us sitting on our own in a room with a notebook. No, God's got to reveal himself to us. Verse 5, you see, he says, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. The place on which you are standing is holy ground. That's not because the place was magic. The place was holy because the holy God was there revealing himself. He was the one that made the ground holy by his presence there. And Moses has to stay at a distance, it says in verse 6. And he hides his face because he's afraid to look at this majestic, holy God. And he has to take off his sandals as a sign of respect. So God is holy. That means he's unique. He's other. He's not like one of us. He's utterly unique and utterly unlike you and I. And if that's true, we can't figure out that God on our own. We can't just go away and sit down with a notebook and a pen and figure out what he's like. If he's so totally unlike us, if he's holy, and he can't even be approached unless it's on his terms, Moses has to take his sandals off and stay at a distance. If that's what the God is like, the real God who made us, then if there's going to be any kind of knowing him, he's going to have to make the initiative. And that's what we see him doing here. And that's a really important lesson. Just before we move on, it's a really important lesson for any would-be God seekers all over the world, whoever they are. God has to be sought on his terms. See, if we want a God that we can put under a microscope and just figure out, then we're not going to find him. If we want a God that fits with our pre-existing notions about what he's going to be like and what he has to be like and what we think things in his world are like, then we don't really want the real God. We just want a God who's going to come along and confirm all of our prejudices. There's nothing sweeter than a prejudice confirmed. But no, the God of the Bible is a God that has to reveal himself to us if we are going to know him. We can't just figure him out with our own effort. If we really want to know him, that means we've got to know him on his terms. And that's true for us, even if we do know him and we want to grow in our knowledge of him. We've got to do that on his terms. We've got to know him, we've got to approach him, we've got to relate to him on his terms and his terms only. It's a God who reveals himself. So it's interesting, whoever we are, to think about in our engagement with God, is there space for him to disagree with us? Is there room in the way that you engage with God for him to disagree with you and to change the way that you think about the world and the way you think about him? Or is it that, no, God's got to conform to the way I think things are and the way I think he is?
well, God reveals himself. And that's a wonderful thing, because otherwise we wouldn't have a chance of knowing him. But he does. He reveals himself here to Moses. But really what it's all about is what he reveals himself like, and that's as a rescuer. That's what most of the chapter is taken up with, God showing that he's the rescuer. So verse 7, he's seen the affliction of his people in Egypt, and he knows their suffering. In verse 8, he sees them and he knows them. Last week we saw those words we used of God, and we saw how their words imply God's involved. God knows their suffering. He doesn't just know it in a detached way, but he knows it in an experiential way. He really knows what they're going through, almost like he's entered into it himself. And so verse 9, it says, now behold, the cry of the people of Israel have come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out. He says, I'm going to send you Moses. And in verse 8, he says, I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, to the land with all those names in it. He knows, he sees, he's sending Moses. He's come down to deliver. He's come down to deliver. You might think he's sending Moses, so he hasn't come down at all. Well, in the Bible, that's not a contradiction in terms. God always works through other human beings. He always works through his creation. He always does that. But you see, God has come down to deliver them. It's a sign of his compassion, isn't it? He's heard their cries under Pharaoh's slavery. He's been moved to come down. He's rolling up his sleeves and he's going to get his hands dirty. And he's going to deliver his people. He's coming down. There's a play on words there in verse 8. I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up. He's come down to bring them up into his land. The picture, isn't it? A vivid picture, actually. I've come down. God stooping down from the highest heaven, stepping into his world in order to lift them out of that situation that they're in. He's stepping into their situation, getting his hands dirty, rolling up his sleeves, getting involved. He's come down to rescue them. And that's why he sends Moses. So see, God reveals himself as the compassionate rescuer. He's not sat up in heaven looking down on things on his creation in some kind of blessed detachment or isolation. No, this is a God who steps in. He comes down. He sees, he knows, and he acts to deliver his people. You see the two sides that we're seeing? God is so holy that we can't figure him out ourselves. He's so unlike anything in his creation. He's the only uncreated thing there is in the universe. He's so holy, and yet that doesn't mean he's detached and isolated and not involved. Actually, he's intimately involved. He knows exactly what his people are going through, and he's come down to deliver. He's a God who steps in. Have we ever wondered whether God gives two hoots about this world and its mess? Or whether your life and its mess? Well, he sees, he knows, and he's come down to deliver. You see, God's commitment to provide rescue to the Israelites was just a part of his commitment to provide rescue for his entire creation that was in a worse mess than even the Israelites were. And one day that commitment led this God to step down in a way even more literal than this passage is on about. God came down in Jesus. He stepped into the mess of our world, and he did it to bring his people out into a new situation. Not a promised land, better than that, a renewed and a perfected creation. That's what God came down in Jesus to accomplish. Not rescue from the slavery of Pharaoh, but rescue from slavery to sin and the death and judgment that brings with it. So who is God? Well, Jesus Christ is God. The God who's revealed himself as the compassionate rescuer. Secondly, God reveals himself as the one we can trust for rescue. God reveals himself as the one we can trust. So our last point was about God being the rescuer. This is about God being reliable. Not surprisingly, you see, Moses isn't so taken with the plan. I bet he thought it was great as he goes through verse 7. Brilliant, God's seen the affliction of the people. Verse 8, he's come down, he's going to deliver them. Brilliant. Verse 9, he says that he's heard them again. All right, get to the point, God. Verse 10, come, I will send you to Pharaoh. But it was at that point that Moses was kind of like, hang on a minute, this isn't so good. And that's pretty much what he says there. Verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Who am I, he says. It's an understandable question, isn't it? Because last time, if you were here last week, we saw in chapter 2, last time Moses had any dealings with Pharaoh, it involved him running as fast in the opposite direction, faster than you or I can say Usain Bolt. But actually, it's an understandable question, but it's the wrong question. It's not the right question. We see that from the way God answers him. Verse 12. But I will be with you. It's interesting, isn't it? God doesn't say to him, don't worry, Moses, you are great. Really, you're brilliant. You don't know it. You're all potential, but you are brilliant. He doesn't say that. He says, but I will be with you. See, who cares who Moses is? It's the wrong question. Who am I is the wrong question. Who are you, God? That's the right question. That's what Moses says next, isn't it? He gets what the right question is. Okay, all right, so you're going to be with me, God. Fine. What happens then when I go to the people of Israel and I say to them, who is this God? And they say to me, who is he? What is his name? What am I going to say to them? In verse 13. Now God, we need to understand Moses' question here. He isn't really saying, God, what is your name? As in, what shall I call you? He isn't worried about being embarrassed when the Israelites say, well, come on, introduce us to this God. And he goes, hang on, actually, you know, I've forgotten his name. You know, one of those situations where you're introducing someone to someone else and that you can't remember the name. It's really embarrassing, isn't it? I'm sorry if I ever do it to you. It's likely to happen at some point. Apologies now from the front. Well, Moses isn't sort of worried about that. He isn't saying, you know, just let me get your name straight, God. I'll write it down. And then when the Israelites ask, I won't be embarrassed. No, what is your name in the Bible is about your character. It's the question, who are you? It's not, what am I going to call you? It's not just about that. He's saying, what's your character? Who are you? Who is this God? Who is he? He's asking for a character reference. What does your name mean? Is what he's saying, really. God gives him an answer that's been famous for centuries, but is also really confusing at first glance. He says, verse 14, I am who I am. At one level, it sounds like God is saying, well, that's for me to know and you to find out. Sounds like he's sort of blowing a raspberry to the question. Well, that's not quite what he's doing. He is saying that's for me to know, because I am who I am says loud and clear, I am the God who defines myself. I am who I am. Think contrast to the gods of Egypt. They were man-made gods. They were able to be manipulated and changed. They were malleable. They were man-made gods, often literally carved out of wood, stone, forged out of gold. Well, God is saying, I'm the self-made God. Never mind the man-made gods. I'm the self-made gods. I am who I am. I define myself. I'm not a God who's a part of creation, made up by people. I am. I exist. And I define myself. I am who I am. I'm the uncreated creator God. And I define myself. But it also means that he's the God who's revealed in his actions. I am who I am is saying, well, look, here I am. Watch this space. You want to know who I am? Step up and have a look. I am who I am. Read my CV. Watch this space. See what I've done and what I'm about to do. Then you'll discover what sort of a God I am. That'll tell you who I am. Because that's what God goes on to say, really. He goes on to show that, actually, if you want to know him, you need to look at his actions.
Verse 15, say this to the people of Israel. The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. The Lord, the God of your fathers, God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. That's God's name. He says, you've got to remember me throughout all generations by that name. So who is God? Well, he says, I'm the God with a history. The God of your forefathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the God who made them some wonderful promises. The God with a track record that you can check out. I've proved myself reliable and faithful time and time again. That's what God I am. But it's not just what God has done in the past, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, that is part of his CV. No, it's actually what he's going to do in the future. That's why he goes on to verse 16. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac and of Jacob has appeared to me saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt. And then it expands on it even more. He says in verse 18, they're going to listen to your voice, Moses, and then you should go and speak to the king of Egypt. Verse 19, but I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favour in the sight of the Egyptians, and when you go, you shall not go empty. You see, he's describing how it's going to unfold from now on. He says, you want to know who I am? I'm the God with a history, and I'm the God who's going to do this stuff. That's who I am. That's who I am. The God who's promised in the past, remembered and knows what's going on in the present, and will not stop till the job is done, despite all the obstacles that Pharaoh is going to throw at him into the future. See, the God who's unstoppably and unchangeably going to rescue them. I am who I am. Now that phrase, I am, it actually echoes down through the centuries until we find in the pages of the New Testament it coming out on the lips of a Jewish rabbi, a teacher. Come to John chapter 8. Just keep your finger in Exodus 3, we'll be back there in a moment. Look at John chapter 8. Verse 56. This is Jesus in the middle of a conversation with some of the Jews who are challenging his authority. And he says, your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. See, all those promises that were made to Abraham, well, Abraham realized that they were about me, says Jesus. So the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? Saying, on what authority are you going to tell us what Abraham saw and thought? Were you around then, Jesus? Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. That's not just bad grammar. It's also the kind of thing that's going to get you stoned. Verse 59, so they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. Why was it so horrendous? Well, because it was blasphemy, wasn't it? Unless it was true. Here he was, a man standing there saying, I am. Do you remember Moses at the burning bush? I am. That's what he's saying. In Jesus, God has declared in a full and a final way that he is unchangeably committed to rescuing his people. He's declared that he's the I am. See, how far would God go? How far would he go in his commitment to his people? Well, in Jesus, the I am, stepped into the world. He came and he lived and he died and he rose again to rescue his people from far worse than Pharaoh could ever throw at them. You see, if God is revealed in his actions, then the ultimate revelation is that action of God where he stepped out of heaven and entered our world, became a man, lived, died, rose again. Who is God? Jesus is God. I am, the God that we can trust for rescue. He's unchangeably committed to it. Thirdly, and come back to Exodus. I'm going to go into chapter 4. Really, our passage for this week is 3 and 4. We're going to dip into chapter 4 as far as we can get. The third thing that we learn is that God reveals himself as fully able to rescue. God reveals himself as fully able to rescue. So if the last point was about his reliability, this point is about his ability, his power. Because you see, in 4 verse 1, Moses isn't convinced by all. And then Moses answered, "But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" By now, maybe you're getting the sneaking suspicion that some of Moses' questions and doubts and problems are actually evasive tactics. He just doesn't want to go. But God treats his questions with dignity and with patience and with quite a lot of kindness, doesn't he? So he gives Moses 3 signs. The first one's there in verse 2. The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" He said, "A staff." He said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand, catch it by the tail." So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. And Moses gives him 3 signs. That's the first one. They're all a little bit bizarre, but actually they're all underlining the same thing. This idea that God is fully able to save, fully able to rescue. Because they all underline that God is in control of his creation. He's totally in control of his creation. He's got authority over his creation and all of his creatures. So you see, the staff that turns into a serpent, the pharaohs often used a serpent as part of their headdress. It was one of the symbols, one of the emblems of the pharaohs. And here Moses is with a serpent, and he runs away from it. Do you remember what happened last time he was in trouble with Pharaoh? He ran away. And God says to him, "Pick it up." And when he picks it up, it returns to a staff. See, God is saying, "I'm with you, and I've got authority over Pharaoh. So don't run away. I'm going to give you authority over him." God's going to enable him to do what he wasn't able to do before, to deal with Pharaoh. And then second up, there's a rather strange incident in verses 6 and 7. Moses puts his hand into his cloak. He comes out and he's got leprosy, some sort of skin disease on it. God says, "Put it back in." Puts his hand back in. He brings it out again. And the leprosy's gone. His hand is clean. It's fine. So God's got authority over Pharaoh. God's also got authority over disease. And the third sign comes there in verse 9. "They will not believe even these 2 signs, or listen to your voice. You shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground." Well, that's really strange, isn't it? But you see, the Nile was a source of life for Egypt, wasn't it? I mean, that was where so much of their industry came from, so much of their ability to produce crops. It was a lifeline for them. And yet blood poured out on the ground in the Bible is always a symbol of death. If there's blood on the ground, it means someone or something has died. See, God is showing that he's got control over Pharaoh and the Nile. And he's even got control over death. See, all of these 3 signs, they actually relate to things God is going to do in future weeks when he brings plagues down on Pharaoh and on Egypt for not letting his people go. Because God is master of his creation and he's got authority over Pharaoh and his gods. He can control disease and sickness. He's even got authority over death. And that's what God brings on Pharaoh and on Egypt. He does turn the Nile to blood in a later chapter. He does bring sickness and disease on the Egyptians. He brings it on the Egyptians and he saves the Israelites from it. See, God is able, fully able to rescue because he's in command of his creation. He's got control of Pharaoh. He's got control of the world that Pharaoh lives in. He's even got control over who lives and who dies. And this powerful God is with Moses. That's what the signs are saying. God is fully able to rescue. And that sort of continues in the next bit. Moses basically complains in verse 10 that he's not very good at public speaking. Oh my Lord, I'm not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. He says, if I go to Pharaoh and talk to him, I'm going to just get a bit tongue-tied. You don't want to send me. Seriously, there are people that can talk better than me. Well, again, God says to him, verse 11, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Who cares if Moses has got a stammer or a stutter or a lisp or a really bad accent? God, Moses' creator, he's got all the resources needed for Moses to go and do the job. God is fully able to save. The plan where he says, I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, is going to work because God's resources are backing it. That's what it's all saying. Even down to verse 15 where he says that he'll teach Moses and Aaron, he says, all right, fine, you can take Aaron, your brother, to help you speak if you want. In verse 15 he says, I will teach you both what to do. He says, look, I'll hold your hand the whole way. See, the Israelites could be sure that the Lord was with Moses, not just because these were fantastic signs and they were a bit crazy, but actually because they pointed directly to God's mastery over his creation. His endless resources for rescuing them and defeating their enemies. He's a creator God, and that makes him uniquely qualified to do what he said he'll do for the Israelites. See, that's true, isn't it, for the rescue plan? If you think about actually all the things that are wrong with the world, whether it's poverty, whether it's sickness, whether it's broken down relationships, whether it's death, whatever it is, all the stuff that's actually wrong with the world is a sign of its brokenness. That it's cracked. What do you need when something's broken? If you really want to fix it, you need the person who made it to come along and fix it. The person who knows how everything goes. The person who can make it do what it ought to do. The Bible's really clear, actually. If we want to be redeemed, if we want salvation, we need our Creator to come and do it. And that's what Moses' God is. He's the Creator. And that means he's the ideal rescuer. You know, who's going to be able to stand against him fulfilling his plans? It's his world. He's got control over every single atom. Who's going to be able to stop him? And it's also what makes Jesus Christ uniquely qualified to be our rescuer. See, we get to the New Testament and we find Jesus Christ, the I Am, God come down to rescue. We find him walking around the place and he's doing signs and wonders that surpass all the stuff that Moses is doing here. I mean, a rod and a snake, you know, that could just be a conjuring trick, couldn't it? But no, we see Jesus calming storms and healing lepers with a touch, casting out demons, raising people from the dead, dying and rising himself. He controls nature, he controls disease, he controls demons, he controls even death itself. He's got power and authority over everything that's broken in creation. Who is God? Jesus Christ is God. He's the God of Exodus 3 and 4. He is fully able to rescue. He lacks no resources. He's fully able to deliver on his rescue plan and his promise of a new creation and perfect future because he's got the authority of the Creator. So you see, which of those three things connected to those three signs is it that you're struggling with? So the serpent was Pharaoh's emblem, wasn't it? But actually, in the Bible's big picture, the serpent isn't the emblem of Pharaoh, really. It's the emblem of Satan. He comes as a serpent in the Garden of Eden to botch everything up in the first place. So what are you struggling with? Are you struggling with temptation? Are you struggling with doubt? Are you struggling with personal sin and with guilt? They're all Satan's weapons. You're struggling with disease? Maybe it's physical illness. Maybe it's
mental illness for you or someone else in the family? Are you struggling with death? Are you suddenly aware of your own mortality for some reason? Or the mortality of a loved one? Are you missing someone? Are you just scared? Which of those things are you facing this week that's threatening your trust in God? All of these things, the brokenness of creation, ultimately caused by our sin. That's why the world is broken, because Adam and Eve sinned and we carried on the job. But it's all brokenness that is fixed by Jesus' death for our sins. Jesus died and rose again to show that a new creation is coming. By the power of the Creator, he's going to renew everything. He's going to fix all the brokenness. He's going to right all the wrongs. He's going to dot all the I's, cross all the T's. He's going to do away with sin, death, Satan forever. So know Moses God in those things that you're struggling with. Grab a hold of Moses God. Know Jesus Christ in the midst of that darkness. See, there's no promise of immediate deliverance now from those things, although God can miraculously do all sorts of things. But there is a promise of deliverance from that, ultimately and in the future, that can bring hope and power to endure those things in the here and now. Just like the Israelites at the very end of chapter 4. When they hear the news, you see, verse 29, they've not yet been fully delivered. They've just heard that it's going to happen. Verse 29, then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. We need to respond like them, don't we? They believed and they bowed their heads and they worshipped. Let's bow our heads. And God said to Moses, then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. Father, thank you that you're the fully able, the reliable, the resourceful rescuer. Help us to trust you in the situations this week where we find that hard to believe. Help us to know you as our God and cling to you through Jesus Christ. Amen.